All right, well, hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Co-op. I am your co-host, Matthew Tyson. Along with me is Rebecca Bratton-Weiss. As always, Rebecca, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, in spite of the fact that we live in an insane world.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited because if you listened to our last episode, when we talked a lot about the issue of abortion and our approach, our approach from a demand side, if you listen to that, then you know that tonight or for this episode, we've got Christopher Hale, who is the Chris. I believe you said that you're in law school now, right? Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I've just started and starting the long haul of going through law school here in D.C.
Right, and so, but you were for a while the executive director for Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good, right?
That's correct, yes. For 3.5 years, I served as the executive director of Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good through this summer, and then started law school, but actually I've started a new project really kind of focused on young Catholics in particular and how young Catholics can respond during this particular era of politics. During the presidency of Donald Trump. So we're just getting started, but it's called the Francis Project, and it's young Catholics across the United States who I think the best way to describe it, feel a little bit of despair of what's going on in our nation's politics, and we have a twofold goal of disrupting what we think are the worst policies of this administration, and then the second goal being rebuilding around those bedrock values that really are at the core of the Catholic Church's social teaching.
Okay. Well, Chris, those of us
sounds great.
Rebecca and I here have been a fan of your work for a while. We've been a fan of we were a fan of Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good and the work you guys were doing. We know that you guys drew the ire of a lot of right wing folks for a long time. So that just makes us love you even more. But I know a little bit about the project that you're doing now, and I'm really excited to see what you do with that. And I'm excited that you've got this new venture. So the plan originally was for us to dive back more into the abortion talk, and we're going to get to that point at some point, because we want to talk a little bit more about our demand approach, and the main reason Christopher was going to be on was to, you know, talk a little bit about that from a more applicable perspective. Christopher, if I'm not mistaken, you've done a lot of work. You've been in D.C. for a while, so you've done a lot of work with the Democratic Party. From volunteering to being up on Capitol Hill, and as a pro-life Democrat and a pro-life liberal, I know that you have been a lot closer to the action, than some of us have. And so, I wanted to get your perspective on that issue. And we're going to get to that, but unfortunately, as Rebecca told me a couple days ago in a message, we have to unfortunately talk about gun violence again. This is the second time since the seventh episode of this podcast, and this is the second mass shooting we've had since this podcast has existed in 7 weeks. Two mass shootings in 7 weeks. This last one was at a church in Texas. A man walked into the service and opened fire and killed, I think, 26 or 27 people with a semi-automatic rifle, and it's a horrible tragedy, and yet we find ourselves right back into the middle of this gun debate, which is honestly, I think, is just wearing thin on me, honestly. What do you guys think? I'm kind of tired of going through the same cycle. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's memes going around now kind of recapitulating the typical arguments that we hear. And, I mean, it's sad. It's a sad, painful irony because when we last talked about gun violence, we said we're not going to stop talking about it because one of the problems is, you know, oh, we have a mass shooting. Everyone's talking about it. Thoughts and prayers, the same arguments, and then the conversation just kind of dissipates, and we said we're not going to let that happen. We're going to keep bringing it up. But then we said, you know, the way things go, it's probably going to be brought up for us. Like one of our we don't really have to look for themes to talk about because when it comes to threats to life, they're happening in the news all the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with you that I'm just not even interested in making the arguments anymore because I know the people clinging to their guns, as they say, don't. I've seen how unwilling they are to listen to the arguments. But I don't know, Christopher, you might have a different perspective on that, coming at things from a different angle, whereas, you know, I'm mostly just involved in ideological disputes.
Well, I think it's interesting. If you look at the Sandy Hook shooting in December of 2012, 20 children were killed and 6 adults, 26 killed. That's going to be the same number that were killed yesterday. Mm-hmm. in Texas. And just reflect for a moment on the response in kind. The Texas shooting is only the second biggest mass shooting in 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so the notion of what consumed this nation in December of 2012 is an afternote, an afterthought, really. The gun debate isn't even percolating past this tragedy 24 hours out. It's we have to recognize those of us who think the gun laws in this country are warped, are anti-life, we're losing. And mm-hmm. we need to acknowledge that mm-hmm. factual reality that we are losing and politically. And what's concerning about it to me is right now, the latest data says 94% of Americans believe in expanded background checks.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we can't get 51 votes in the United States Senate to make it happen. And so that's telling you that there's something warped about the way we're going about this, but also too that the whole life movement that we're a part of, we probably in a lot of ways can be the linchpin for moving the ball forward. If we can give the traditional pro-life movement, if they could give an inch of the energy they give every January when they march on Washington towards mm-hmm. this issue, we would win.
Absolutely.
We just need a few more votes in the United States Senate in particular to move the ball forward. And so I think mm-hmm. there's something to be said about making a whole life, pro-life argument to conservatives and convincing them that we're right on this issue and that to be pro-life is to not support the current gun laws in the United States. I think that's the best way forward.
Well, Chris, and that's interesting that you mentioned that because I was, you know, I have something kind of to relate that to today. I'm working on an article for for AL.com right now about marijuana law because even in somewhere like Alabama, there's actually a huge amount of support among both Republicans and Democrats and people and just regular citizens for, at the very least, medical marijuana, especially in Alabama, where we have a massive opiate crisis right now. Okay. Some of our strongest Republican leaders, and because we're a Republican-dominated state, have even come out and said that they're in favor of reforming the marijuana laws, and yet we can't get anything done about it. And so it's interesting to me that, you know, that I say that to relate to what you just said, Chris. We have a mass amount of people in this country who see basic, simple things like expanded background checks and even like the closing of like the gun show loophole and things of that nature, that these are just really simple, common sense laws that the majority of the people support, and yet you have a government, a Republican-dominated government, that refuses to move on this because, and the reason they use is because of the fact that they want to support the Second Amendment, and their supporters don't want them to do these things. They don't want them to support these background checks, and they don't want them to expand any kind of gun regulation. And so, like, you know, where is the breakdown between, you know, something that should be just a very obvious common sense thing that we need to address, something that I feel like is just regular adults we should be able to say, yeah, this is a problem, we need to address this, and this idea that I'm afraid if I speak out against this that my constituents are not going to vote me back into office?
I think there's really a one-fold reality. There's one elephant in the room that we have to acknowledge in this debate. And that's the National Rifle Association, the NRA.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Really, your listeners probably know very well of the NRA, but really, you've seen the past 25 years under the really since the Clinton administration, the NRA has moved further and further to the right. Mm-hmm. George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States, rescinded his membership in the NRA because he thought they had become too extremist under Wayne LaPierre, their current executive vice president, really the leader of the organization. Here's the reality. The NRA does not well represent the views of its membership. It's kind of like the old stereotype of a 1930s a mob run union. The leadership does not represent the rank and file. So really, right. I think to win going forward on gun safety, ending gun violence in this country, it's going to go through the NRA. And I think we kind of have two options. Particularly, we're talking amongst some Southerners here. There's two possibilities that we could do. One is those who disagree with the positions of the leadership of the NRA can actually seek reform from the inside. Instead of renouncing membership in the NRA like George H.W. Bush, there actually could be progressives who join the NRA and demand change from within the inside of the organization. There's a sense that if the rank and file of the National Rifle Association actually won on the questions of policy within the NRA, we would be for expanded background checks. And the second possibility is to marginalize the NRA. That seems less likely. There's a movement among progressives here in Washington, D.C., that I'm a Tennessean. I can't see this working very well where I come from. The idea that if you can marginalize gun ownership, if you can marginalize the NRA, and actually, in a very similar way like we did with smoking, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, and it'd actually be an effective means. Like, you won't date gun owners. You will exclude them from, you know, from mainstream society. I'm just not convinced that's an effective move because it becomes a regionalized weapon. So I kind of like
That's definitely not going to work where I am.
No, same here.
No, and I don't think it will, but I do think that if we can have the rank and file of the NRA, we should organize within the NRA. I think it's worth throwing money towards. I don't own a gun, but I am a member of the NRA. And I think there's enough folks, especially in the South. I think that's where the power dynamics lie. If we can get folks to speak up within the National Rifle Association, the origins of the institution no longer reflect what it does day to day. And I think we can take back the NRA. I'd love to see more money, more resources, more energy behind that cause.
Well, that's interesting that you say
that. That's a fascinating idea. Yeah, I mean, I actually own guns myself, and one of the things about being a gun owner is that I feel that I need to take it very, very seriously and ask myself the way I think and the way I respond to the news, whether I am even thinking in a responsible and pro-life way, because if not, I shouldn't own guns.
Exactly.
But I rejected membership in the NRA years ago because I just became disgusted with this, you know, gun fetishism and lack of concern for life. But yeah, your idea, it's radical, it's subversive.
That's interesting.
And it reminds me of, you know, kind of some of our conversations about the abortion issue, too, where it seems as though the ones who are the most vocal in calling the shots have this very far-right, misogynistic, kind of ultimately anti-life approach to opposing abortion, whereas many who are kind of, you know, boots on the ground in the movement, pro-life, are not well represented by individuals like Father Frank Pavone or by the President of the United States. So, yeah.
Well, I think this is something we should consider in terms of the whole life movement in general. I think we have really, there's two binaries that we have. One is we can protest from the outside, and there's something to be said about that. But I think, too, we shouldn't be afraid of the grittiness of getting involved from the inside. the whole life movement, I think, should be present at the March for Life and should be a forceful part of it. And we might not agree with the tactics and the worldview of Father Frank Pabon or Susan B. Anthony List or the rest.
Right.
But I think that if we can take the argument to the pro-life community, I think we're going to have a lot more folks in the rank and file that are with us. So I think there is, I think there's a desperate need for folks like us who we are weirdos. We have a marginalized view we're strangers in our own backyard, you know.
Yes.
And so we're strangers at the March for Life, and we're strangers at the Democratic National Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to have this willingness to engage in both worlds.
Well, Chris, and to that point too, though, and this is something Rebecca and I have spoken about pretty often, is that we are strangers at the Democratic National Convention, but I have a lot easier time getting pro-choice people to listen to me than I
absolutely
do right-wing pro-life people listening to me. And and one of the whole reasons that the new pro-life movement exists in the first place is because of the fact that it became very apparent that the pro-life movement and Priests for Life and Susan B. Anthony List and National Right to Life, which long time ago lost any kind of credibility with me, but if they had any, it would have gone down the drain the moment they endorsed Roy Moore for senator, which they did very recently.
Right.
Which, by the way, Chris, I know you're out there in Virginia campaigning. I hope you're going to come down to Alabama and campaign for Doug Jones at some point.
Absolutely.
We've got a couch. You're more than welcome to crash on our couch. But
December 12th, right? We got 5 weeks left.
Yeah, 5 weeks. It's getting really, really close. But the problem, you know, one of the biggest problems that we have with the modern pro-life movement, and it kind of plays into both the abortion issue and the gun rights issue, is that it's become very apparent that a lot of the main modern, what we call old pro-life staples, nonprofits and political entities have become a lot less focused on the issue of abortion, really, and have become more focused on making sure that Republicans stay in office and stay in power. And we've talked before about how, like, the Republican Party utilizes the pro-life movement to stay in office, but doesn't actually ever make good on their promises. You know, we've seen how efficient the government can actually be when they want to be about something, and the Republicans have had an opportunity in every single decade since Roe versus Wade was passed to do something about abortion on a bigger scale, and they haven't. So what do you do about that? Because Chris, I agree with you that we can make change from in the rank and file, but what do you do when the rank and file is Republican before they're pro-life? What do you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
I think the reality of it is that you have to call it out. And I think there's distinctions that need to be made. My sense of it is, and I'm a millennial, so I'm biased. My sense of it is, if you start looking with, I think when you start looking at the realities and the breakdown of the pro-life movement here in the United States, the quote-unquote old pro-life movement, the traditional pro-life movement, there's worthy distinctions to be made between millennials and baby boomers. I find that boomers are oftentimes hardened by old conflicts and old ideological and political battles that were before our time and are no longer relevant to the worldview that we operate in. And so I think that to some degree we have to find where the traction is. I'm not going to waste my time trying to convince quite unfrankly older right-wing staunch conservatives that there is a widening view of what it means to be pro-life and different ways to practice that, but I might try to convince that man's daughter. And
sure.
I think we have to look for the openings. And I think my sense of it is it is very much defined by age. I think the younger you get on the conservative pro-life arena, the more willing they are to listen to our new pro-life cause.
Sure.
And I think and also, too, I think one thing I would say within that is I hope your listeners read Matthew's piece on Doug Jones
I'll share. I'll link it.
You wrote AFL.com. The question but I think the authenticity of our view, we are truly pro-life. We believe that life begins at conception. However, it doesn't end there. Mm-hmm. I think we can make a compelling argument, and I think Matthew does, and I think we can make this argument to our peers, that just because a party does not agree with us on this issue doesn't mean that they actually can't be a vehicle for helping the cause.
Right. Exactly.
I think we have to communicate that again and again.
Yeah, and I think that what you say about the generational difference there is so true, and I've seen it. I mean, I'm an old Gen Xer myself, but I've seen it also on the pro-choice side, where women, kind of second wave white feminists in particular, have the same mantras about their body and their choice, and in some cases I understand that they are rightly terrified of going back to the kind of anti-woman existence that made abortion seem desirable in the first place. And so I've said often, I'm not trying to go back to before Roe v. Wade. I'm trying to go to a future that we haven't seen before. But these are people who often don't want to engage. I haven't found them to be as malicious as the old school right-wing pro-lifers are. I mean, it was the old school right-wing pro-lifers who worked hard to deprive me of my income. So but at the same time, while these assholes, old fogies with their, you know, cushy incomes were maneuvering behind the scenes to get me fired, the young people I was teaching were very, very open to a consistent life approach. And, you know, especially when we were reading stories in literature classes, that it talked about, like, the dilemmas of poor women, the dilemmas of racially other people. They were very open to it, and I feel like that's the demographic that can be interested in both a pro-life ethos and a pro-woman ethos. I mean, pro-life should be pro-woman. Absolutely. So, you know, care for the unborn and also care for the pregnant woman. Well, so, yeah, I'm with you all on that.
One of the things that really solidified the whole demand approach thing for me, and I had long since developed my belief that demand is something that we need to focus on more than supply, just from a realistic standpoint. But I like to do talks about new pro-life movement and being a pro-life Democrat to college Democrat groups, and I try to do them at county party groups down here. And I met with two people that led up the county right next to us, St. Clair County. I met with the husband and wife that are that run the St. Clair County Democratic Club, and I wanted to go and speak with them about being pro-life and pro-life Democrat, and it didn't work out, but we had an interesting conversation, and it is so eye-opening to me. And I've said this before, that every single person who considers themselves pro-life, they need to go and sit down and spend an hour or two with a pro-choice person who was alive before Roe v. Wade. Because when you speak to people who came after Roe v. Wade about abortion rights, they always speak about it in a historical context. And it's something that, well, it's a right, and here's why we did that, blah, 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 blah. But when you talk to someone who was around before Roe v. Wade, they can tell you in detail. They remember the horror stories of what women had to go through. And it's so interesting, because if you grow up and if you spend a lot of time in the pro-life movement, and especially the modern pro-life movement, you come to see people who support abortion or women who have had an abortion as these awful, evil people. You learn to vilify them. But if you go and you actually talk to someone, a pro-choice person who was around before Roe v. Wade, you realize that there's a significant amount of fear, honestly, of fear about going back to the way it was, because they remember a time when women If they didn't have enough money and they couldn't go see a doctor, you know, who would see them in the, you know, in his basement or whatever, they would have to go to a poor part of town and to a, you know, to a shady apartment or whatever and have someone perform the procedure for them. They remember when it was literally back alley abortions and dangerous, and yeah. they have a fear of us going back to that. And I think they're very justified in that fear because, as Rebecca and I have talked about before, the need or the perceived need for abortion in this crisis pregnancy has been around for as long as we've been recording history. It's something that's been around for mm-hmm. a long time. It is something that is seen as a legitimate need, and that's why we focus on the demand perspective, because it's easy to see why people are afraid to go back to that to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. And so much of the need or perceived need, the desire, does have to do with misogynistic pressures in like patriarchal societies going back, as you say, as long as history has been recorded. And that's why I don't think a woman in her right mind would trust anyone on the contemporary right to solve this problem, because they're so clearly anti-woman. They may be pro-feminine if you're super feminine and frilly, but actual living women with bodies and ideas and thoughts and hopes and fears, they are not supportive of us. And I know this hurts their feelings when I say that, but they can toughen up. I think that in terms of solving the problems that drive women to abortion, ironically, some of the pro-choice activists out there might be doing a better job. I've uttered heresy in saying this.
Well, Chris, I do have a question for you.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you this because I know that you've been involved with the Democratic Party, again, in a little bit closer than we have. So just to kind of go back to what we were talking about with the current Alabama election, with Doug Jones, you know, he caused an uproar not too long ago because he went on CNN, and he gave an interview where he was asked point blank if he supported the 20-week ban, and he said he didn't support any legislation that was gonna stop get in the way of a woman's right to choose. So I wrote that article for AL.com about voting for him anyway because of his policies, and then it got picked up by a right-wing radio host here in Alabama who brought me onto the show the next week, and he did exactly what I expected him to do when he asked me about why. You know, he immediately launched into this idea that because Doug Jones said that he doesn't support any kind of restrictions on abortion, that obviously means that he supports abortion up until the point of birth. And I tried to make the point that that's not what Doug Jones nor any Democrat is really thinking about,
right,
when they're talking about abortion rights, because you know, one of the things the pro-life movement likes to do, and this is actually something that I think has been detrimental to the movement, is they focus entirely too much on the post-20-week abortions, the D&E abortions, the things that are really, really gory. And the reality is that when we are talking about abortion, we're not usually talking about that. It's something that happens and it exists, and that's something that needs to be dealt with. But most of the time, when you're talking about the concept of abortion rights, you're usually talking about the 80 to 90% of women who are having abortions in the first and early second trimester, you know, long before the 20-week mark or anything like that. And so what we find, I think, though, is this difficult point where it becomes hard to talk about the issue. Because on one hand, you have Democrats who are too afraid to really get into the weeds about the abortion issue and who are, I honestly think, too afraid to say, I support a woman's right to choose, but I think at some point we need to draw the line. And then you have these Republicans who hear them, who automatically jump to, well, you obviously support, you know, live abortions or partial birth abortions, whatever.
Right.
But really, when Democrats are talking about abortion rights, they're talking about those first trimester issues, which if we're going to go back to the ideological standpoint, obviously it's still a human being. It doesn't matter. Morally, it's still wrong. No one is really on the same page, is what I'm getting at, when we talk about the abortion issue to first hand. No one is really on the same page. I don't think anyone is ever really talking at a level point. So, Chris, from someone who's been involved in this, I know this is kind of a long roundabout, but someone who's been involved in this, what can we do to get Democrats to get a little bit more specific about the issue of abortion and be willing to engage on a much more complex, comprehensive level, and especially when it comes to the fact that, you know, America has some of the most lax abortion laws in the world. How do you get Democrats to get on board with the idea that maybe it's okay to draw the line at 20 or 22 weeks? And then how do we work with Republicans to get them to go, look, you've got to talk about things in a more realistic a tone. You've got to talk about things the way that they actually are, and not these very few 0.01%, you know, abortion. How do you get people to sort of come together in this very realistic situation and talk about what we can do to both reduce abortion and protect women at the same time? I know that's not a loaded question at all, Christopher, but, like, you know, what can we...
It's a great question.
What can we do about that?
I think...
Enlighten us.
I think if I got the 100 United States senators in the room, it's my belief, Roy Moore excluded, if he wins, he won't. Doug Jones will.
I hope so.
But it's my view that the 100 United States senators are more astute than their counterparts in the House. If you blind tested them, blind polled the 100 United States senators, almost every one of them would agree that it's better for the United States if there's less abortions in 2017 than there were in 2016. It's very, very hard to get the Democratic Party to acknowledge that. And I want to explain why that is. And it's also very hard to get the Republican Party to praise that. And I want to explain that as well. So on Democrats, it seems to me that Democrats are unwilling to acknowledge publicly that less abortion is worthwhile. And the Republicans, on the same hand, are unwilling to praise less abortion because it's not zero. I want to kind of explain each side why this is. The Democratic Party, the platform said in 1996 and 2000, that they hoped that abortion would be safe, legal, and rare. That language was famously coined by Bill Clinton in his political triage in 96. Dick Morris was probably the one who created it, actually, his Republican advisor. The language of rare, why is that frustrating to pro-choice activists on the left, particularly Planned Parenthood? They don't like it because they believe it puts this sense of moral judgment, which it does maybe in some ways, on the question of abortion. And they want what they would call a shameless abortion. That's interesting. And, to some degree, I have sentiments of understanding of that we definitely shouldn't shame people who obtain abortions. But they take it to an extreme. And so... Elise Hogue, the president of NARAL, at the Democratic National Convention last year in 2016 in Philadelphia, started this movement of shouting your abortion, like no shame behind abortion. So for the Democrats to acknowledge that one less abortion is better would be having a culture of quote-unquote shame around abortion. That's one thing. On the Republican side, to acknowledge that pragmatically to have less abortions would be conceding that we're never going to live in a culture with zero abortions.
Right.
I think going forward, both the Democrats and the Republicans need to coalesce around something they both acknowledge privately, that the United States is better off with less abortion than more abortion in order to status quo.
Chris, you know, I agree completely with what you're saying, I hope to see those conversations take place. I do think that there's a lot to be said for external factors for organizations like NARAL and Planned Parenthood's political wing and other major political pro-choice organizations that I think maybe drive these divisions a little bit too far. I think that they I understand where they're coming from. I understand they're there to protect rights and to stand up for what they feel is a good cause, but at the same time, I think they do a lot of division. And these are also usually people that are that I feel at least are from an activist, you know, activist, people that make the most noise, who are the least willing to budge and to concede that, you know, that half the country is actually very uncomfortable with the concept of abortion. But, you know, of course, in the pro-life movement has to accept the fact that half the country, even if they're uncomfortable with it, a lot of them don't want to do anything about it from a legal perspective. And that, and again, that all comes back to the idea that we've got to focus on that demand perspective. Because, like you say, Christopher, we're never going to live in a world without abortion. And I mean, people think that Roe versus Wade invented abortion. It didn't. You know, a Roe versus Wade, to me, has always just been a reaction to the reality, unfortunate reaction, in my opinion, but a realistic one nonetheless. And so yeah, I think everything you're saying, we've got to get people to have these conversations. We've got to get people to meet in the middle. You know, most of the pro-choice people I meet, even honest to God, can see some legitimacy in some of the middle ground that we bring out. And so I think that there's a lot. And of course, you know, people like you, Christopher, need to keep moving and keep driving this conversation forward. And we're going to do our part to do that as well. Well, thank you, Christopher, for tuning in with us today. We've really appreciated having you. You are our first guest, believe it or not. You are our first guest on the show. And you survived. So we're thrilled to have you on, and we're glad that you were to make it. We hope that you'll come back again sometime and join us again for more conversations in the future. As always, please remember, if you're feeling generous, to become a subscriber to the show. $9.99 a month gets you some great deals from advertisers, but more importantly, it helps us. It helps us spread our message. It helps us build our platform and get this to more people. So just know that every subscription helps us do that. It helps us grow, and it helps us put the new pro-life movement out there, and we really, really appreciate it. I thank you so much for tuning in. This has been a great show. Okay. Christopher, again, thank you for tuning in and coming with us. And I guess we'll see you next time.
Thank you all. Thank you so much.